Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the websites boardpanda.com and onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this very day, back in 1911, that composer Gustav Mahler died. What were his last words? Hint, each of the following was said as last words by a famous person, but only one of them was said by Gustav Mahler. Which one is his? Is it A, I'm so bored with it all? Is it B, Mozart? Is it C, applaud, my friend, the comedy is finished? Or is it D, die, my dear? Why, that's the last thing I'll do. Or was it E, I should never have switched from scotch to martinis? Gustav Mahler's last words. And question number two. It was on this very day that a cover of a number one hit from 1929 was released in 1968. This version of the song went all the way to number 17 on the charts. So, what was the name of this hit song from 1929? Hint, here's a snippet from that 1968 cover. Sound familiar? So what's the name of this song? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of May the 17th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1958, that Bobby Darin's single, Splish Splash, was released as the first 8-track master recording pressed to a plastic 45 RPM disc. Today, back in 1958. And finally, in transitions, we have this article by Al Jean Harmitz, written in the New York Times on the 14th of May, 2019. Doris Day, the freckle-faced movie actress whose irrepressible personality and golden voice made her America's top box office star in the early 1960s, died Monday at her home in Carmel Valley, California. She was 97. Day began her career as a big band vocalist, and she was successful almost from the start. One of her first records, Sentimental Journey, released in 1945, sold more than a million copies, and she went on to have numerous other hits. Bandleader Les Brown, with whom she sang for several years, once said, "As a singer, Doris belongs in the company of Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra. But it is with the movies that made her a star. Between 1948 and 1968, she starred in nearly 40 movies. When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand. Benny King's Stand By Me introduces our country music news. It's an article entitled, Kiefer Sutherland, TV Star, the country singer. After early fame and action hero success, the 24 tough guy decided to explore his other passion, music. This is written by Jillian Telling and published in People magazine, April 29, 2019 issue. When Kiefer Sutherland first left his hometown of Toronto for New York City at 17 for a theater role, he had no idea his career would suddenly take off like a rocket. "I did two plays, went to California, and got my first film jobs," recall Sutherland, now 52, the son of actors Donald Sutherland and Shirley Douglas, earned instant success playing big-screen bad boys, including Bully, Ace, in Stand By Me, and vampire leader David in The Lost Boys. Stand by me. In his mid-20s, he showed off his sexy swagger in Young Guns and Flatliners, where he met his one-time fiancée, Julia Roberts. Later, he found a second act as a TV action hero, winning an Emmy for the hit 2001 through 2010 Fox series 24, and playing the president on Designated Survivor, which has moved from ABC to Netflix. But he always yearned to be a musician. When 24 ended, he started taking songwriting seriously. "I've loved music since I was young," says Sutherland. "I always played guitar and violin and a little piano." His inspirations are classic country rebels such as Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard. "It got to the point where I had a lot of songs," he says. Still, he didn't feel confident enough to record them himself. Now, Sutherland, 40, has fully embraced his troubadour persona. He has played 300 shows in the last 2.5 years and is about to release his second album, Release Reckless and Me. The article skips down and ends with this. "What he enjoys most is bonding with fans. I know I'm one of the luckiest people I've ever met, but that doesn't mean you get to go through life without having any difficulties," he says. "The loss of someone you love, or a broken heart, or a disappointment. When I listen to a song and realize the artist is going through the same thing, I make a real connection. That, for me, as a songwriter, is the ultimate goal." Aaron Copland's fanfare for the common man opens our classical music news. Beethoven and Copland, a concert by the NC Symphony. This is published in ncsymphony.org. Coming up this Friday, May the 17th, and Saturday, May the 18th at 8 p.m., Mymandy Concert Hall, Raleigh. Grant Llewellyn, conductor. Jonathan Biss, piano. Jonathan Biss brings his masterful artistry to one of Beethoven's most touching works, the Piano Concerto No. 3, along with a co-commission, North Carolina native and Pulitzer Prize winner Caroline Shaw's new piano concerto. Copland's euphoric Symphony No. 3, declared the greatest American symphony ever written, makes for a rollicking season finale. Written at the end of World War II, Copland's Symphony No. 3 is known as the essential American symphony that fuses his distinct Americana style of the ballets with the form of the symphony, which has generally been a European-dominated musical form. The fanfare for the common man, the song playing in the background now, is used as a theme in the fourth movement of Copland's Symphony No. 3. Various fragments from fanfare are also used for primary thematic material in the first three movements. Go to ncsymphony.org or phone 919 733-2750 for more details and ticket information. And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled, On the Record, A Passion for Treasure Hunting Drives This Hidden Store. This is written by Will Lingo, published in Walter Magazine, May 2019. Hello, vinyl champions. So begins a video of Kirk Adams hauling out his latest stash of records to share with devotees on Instagram and YouTube. He flips through the albums, describing each briefly, knowing the people will come, which may not be as easy as you'd expect. Record Crates, that's spelled with a K, by the way, crate, address is on St. Mary Street, but from the street you'll see nothing but beauty salons. Seasoned veterans know that around back there's a door that opens the gateway to record heaven. Adams has thousands of vinyl records, not to mention the cassettes, CDs, DVDs, video games, and some other stuff you just have to see to believe. And over the last 5 years, he has gradually taken over the entire lower level of the building, after starting in just a couple of rooms. Adams says he's been a self-described vinyl champion for most of his life. He remembers his aunt letting him listen to her records, and Chapel of Love by the Dixie Cups struck an immediate chord, while the rest of the world moved on to cassettes, then CDs, and purely digital media. His love never wavered. Adams grew up in Raleigh and made his way as an artist and an art teacher, but he never limited his passion to visual arts. Art and music always go together for me because art is music and music is art, he says. Adams believes art is to be enjoyed, not acquired and filed away. He's a hunter, not a collector. He wants to find cool records and listen to them and then pass them along. I never thought about collecting, he says. I always had records that I would look that looked interesting to me. It was always about the hunt for the next record. He opened Record Crate in 2014. Now people call him when they have records to sell, whether from personal collections or estates. I used to hunt, and now the door opens and they walk in, Adams says. His love for the music and medium is clear, and happily shares it with anyone who walks in the door. His newbies find their way in the store, too. Record Crate has a ramshackle charm, but the casual facade is a cover for a lot of work and organization, and it's paid off. Adams has employees now, as well as locations in Wake Forest, Wendell, and Selma. He also sells a good bit of new inventory, which he couldn't have imagined even a few years ago. But in the front room of the store, you'll still find a turntable that's always running. It may be the Pretenders when you walk in, but Adams will likely ask what you'd like to hear next, because he's always on the hunt to hear something new. Whatever comes my way, I'm happy. Record Crate, by the way, is located at 508 St. Mary Street. It's open Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., Saturday and Sunday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. How does it feel? Like a Rolling Stone introduces our rock music news. It's an article entitled, World's Oldest Hot New Rocker. Music writer Larry Sloman's long road from adoring fan to recording artist. And this is published in the May 2019 issue of AARP, the magazine. Written by Larry Sloman. When I was in second grade, Elvis Presley was my hero. I wanted to be him. My parents would bring the neighbors in, and I'd stand in front of our TV in my underwear, strumming a broomstick and crooning Love Me Tender. Later at my bar mitzvah, I sang my Haftarah, a selection from the Book of Prophets, doing my best Elvis impersonation. The head of the temple asked me if I wanted to be a cantor. No way, so I put my musical career on indefinite hold. After high school, I went to Queens College in New York, where I was on track for a nice middle-class existence. Then I brought Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan. That single changed my life. Instead of focusing on my studies, I started going to see revolutionary bands such as The Fugs and The Mothers of Invention and writing about what I'd seen. First for a school newspaper, then for Rolling Stone magazine. Before long, I was writing a book about Dylan's legendary 1975 Rolling Thunder tour, which also featured Joan Baez, who gave me the nickname Ratso, Joni Mitchell, and Roger McGinn of the Byrds. Watching these legends perform nightly was exhilarating. It moved me to try my hand at songwriting. On one train ride, I showed Dylan my first attempt at lyrics, a song about a seedy part of Boston. He looked it over as I waited nervously. Finally, he said, "Hey, this is good, man." Coming from your hero, the simplest words of praise can make you feel like you've been nominated for a Nobel Prize. Back in New York, I mainly wrote articles and books, but also dabbled in lyrics. My career as a part-time lyricist fizzled out by the mid-1980s. Then a few years ago, a friend and I started doing a podcast from an East Village bar, and that's how I met two rockers who invited me into Brooklyn's indie music scene. When I hang out with them, I was always the oldest person in the room, but that didn't deter me. I just put on one of my wildest suits and walked in like I owned every venue. My musical juices started flowing again. I dug up my old books of lyrics and decided to put out an album with other people singing my songs. I asked a new friend, singer-songwriter Vin Caccione, to help with the project, but he threw me a curve. "Why are you going to give these songs to other people?" he asked. "You've got a unique voice." Unique voice. Was that a good thing? I guessed I'd find out. Vin and I got to work, and eventually we had an album, followed by a record contract. Now we have a band, and we're rehearsing to perform the songs live. I may have taken a 60-something year detour, but I'm finally about to fulfill my dream of that little kid in his underwear strumming a broomstick. This time, though, I'm doing it with my clothes on and in my own unique voice.
When you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. You're invisible now, you got no secrets to conceal.
Orchestra playing in the mood introduces our jazz music news. It's an article entitled "The Disappearance of Glenn Miller, The Search for Clues in a 75-Year Mystery." A research team sets out to find the band leader's missing plane, even as questions remain about what really happened the day Miller vanished during World War II. This article is written by Jordan Rundhag, published in People magazine, April 1st, 2019 issue. On December 15, 1944, Glenn Miller crossed the stormy tarmac at England's RAF Twinfield Farm airfield and boarded the waiting UC-64A Norseman. The famed bandleader behind swing hits like In the Mood and Moonlight Serenade was due in Paris for a Christmas broadcast to boost the morale of weary World War II troops. With most flights grounded because of the treacherous weather and poor visibility, Miller had accepted a ride with Lieutenant Colonel Norman F. Bazewell an Army Air Force acquaintance, and his 22-year-old pilot, John Morgan. At 1:53 p.m. that afternoon, they took off in a haze of thick fog, flew out over the English Channel, and were never seen again. While they were presumed lost at sea, no trace of the plane has ever officially been recovered. Alongside the enigma surrounding Amelia Earhart's disappearance, Glenn Miller's lost plane is one of aviation's most captivating mysteries. Now, an organization based in Oxford, Pennsylvania, is hoping to solve the 75-year-old cold case. The Miller aircraft is the only Norseman that's unaccounted for. If you find that, you found Miller's aircraft. In locating the wreck, Gillespie hopes to put to bed the dozens of conspiracy theories that have cropped up over the years, including he died of a heart attack in France. He was found guilty by the Germans of espionage and assassinated. He died in a hospital bed of cancer, and that his plane was downed by friendly fire. Sprague believes it was the perfect storm of circumstances that caused the plane to crash into the channel. While transport planes in England had been grounded because of the weather, Basil ordered his flight to go ahead, forcing Morgan to fly under dangerous condition. The Norseman's engine was susceptible to freezing, and Morgan was likely flying at a lower altitude, making it virtually impossible to recover if the engine quit and the plane started to nosedive. I cannot imagine what the final thoughts of somebody are when you hear the engine backfire and stop, says Sprague. They had time to know what was happening to them. It's hard for people to wrap their minds around the idea of an important person suddenly being killed in an accident, he adds. But we're human. We make mistakes. And finally, in local music news, we have this. From New York, the world-famous Glenn Miller Orchestra. Their greatest hit show, that's opening up on July 15, 2019 at 7 p.m. The Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts, my Mandy Concert Hall, 2 East South Street in Raleigh. July 15th. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our second question, it was on this day that a cover of a number one hit from 1929 was released in 1968. This version of the song went all the way to number 17 on the charts. So what was the name of that hit song from 1929? And I played a snippet from the 1968 cover as a hint. Correct answer: Tiptoe Through the Tulips. As noted in songfacts.com, ukulele player Tiny Tim's one and only hit was his high-pitched falsetto rendition of the pop standard Tiptoe Through the Tulips. The original version, a number one hit, was by the crooner Nick Lucas, who sung it in the 1929 musical Gold Diggers of Broadway. It was composed by Tin Pan Alley songwriters Joe Burke and Al Dubin, who later, with the composer Harry Warren, wrote such standards as We're in the Money, I Only Have Eyes for You, and Lullaby of Broadway. And the answer to our first question, it was on this very day, back in 1911, that composer-conductor Gustav Mahler died. What were his last words? Hint, each of the following was said as last words by a famous person. Which one is Gustav Mahler's? Is it A, I'm so bored with it all? Actually, those were Winston Churchill's last words. Was it C, applaud, my friend, the comedy is finished? No, those were Beethoven's last words. Was it die, my dear? Why, that's the last thing I'll do. Those were Groucho Marx's last words, of course. Was it E, I should never have switched from scotch to martinis? That was Humphrey Bogart's last words. Answer B, Mozart. Yes, this was Gustav Mahler's famous last word. The grisly thought about a deathbed might be quite unnerving for anyone, but not for these famous people. Knowing the last words that someone spoke can sometimes throw light on their character or on the circumstances in which they died. These famous last words can sometimes be ironically funny and other times eloquent and truly deep. And as quoted in 10 Fun Facts About Gustav Mahler by cmuse.org on July 21, 2014, Gustav Mahler composed during the early morning hours, and later in the day he swam, ran, and cycled. He especially loved the outdoors and alpine trails. He once told a visitor to his summer cottage, "Don't bother looking at the view. I've already composed it." Mahler's Symphony No. 8 was nicknamed the Symphony of a Thousand by Mahler's agent because its premiere performance featured over 150 orchestra members and over 800 choral singers. Sadly, Gustav Mahler never experienced popularity as a composer during his lifetime. He was better known as a conductor. He is considered to be one of the most passionate and greatest conductors in music history. Mahler was reportedly difficult to work with. He had a nasal, high-pitched voice, was authoritarian, and prone to anger. And he was a stickler for even minor details, though he got results professionally. He also made enemies. Mahler's music is featured on more than 100 film soundtracks. The Curse of the Ninth Symphony is a superstition among composers that implies that after their Ninth Symphony is written, they will die. Some composers, including Mahler, did actually take it seriously. Mahler, therefore, called his Ninth Symphony Das Lied von der Erde instead of numbering it, and called his subsequent symphony the Ninth Symphony. For what it's worth, he died while writing his Tenth Symphony. In honor of the first 8-track master recording pressed into plastic 45 RPM disc today, back in 1958, let's close out our program with that singer, Bobby Darin, singing his 1959 hit, Beyond the Sea.
Welcome to the Crystal Room at the lovely Desert Inn. I'd like to take you on a musical trip, if I may, back to 1959. Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on Tommy Sands and watches the ships that go sailing.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.
Beyond the shore, we will kiss just as before.